Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. A reminder, you know I'm going to remind you about this, that you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, any place where you have a podcast. And if you like what you hear, I've been told that it helps us if you leave a positive review. And if you really don't like us, well, then you probably just want to pass on that. Joining me today, A.B. Stoddard, who is an associate editor and columnist at Real Clear Politics and a contributor to The Bulwark as well. A.B., good to have you back.
Great to be with you, Charlie.
Well, where should we start here? We should talk Beto Mania. Right before we start, I was telling you that I got to sit and listen to the whole town hall meeting in Iowa, Beto Mania in just full cry. I don't know whether all three cable networks carried it, sort of felt like it. But here's our new reality. And my initial take was, whether you like it or not, he's an immediate one of the at least four front runners: Biden, Bernie, Kamala, and Beto. And in an attention economy where the scarcest resource is attention, he's pretty much guaranteed to get an awful lot. Your take on Beto Mania?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, look, he is he's going to be a semi-Trumpian reality show because he has admitted that he likes to do things his way. He doesn't do a lot of prep. He shoots from the hip. He feels things. And he kind of it just goes on vibe and trusts himself enormously and has disdain for professionals. So interesting leap from a Senate race to a presidential race that's already very crowded with people who've been planning for a very long time and targeting their resources, you know, very effectively, and obviously sought counseling from the professionals. And then you have people like Biden and Bernie who are veterans of this. And so he does have a cult following, however, and that is we are an age where I don't like cults, but apparently other people do and they join them. And he starts out with an enormous a group of super fans. And LeBron had his Beto cap on. There were Beto signs all over the country, nowhere near his Senate race in Texas against Ted Cruz last fall. And there's just a the phenom factor actually gives him a leg up, certainly, and puts him in that top five attention getting bucket.
Yeah, and the term superfan I think is important here because in order to measure the support for a candidate, it's not just the numbers, it's that level of intensity. And for people who think, well, okay, he's just a celebrity. Last two presidential election cycles, we've seen how that's played out. I mean, we're sort of through that. Are we looking for gravitas, or are we looking for somebody who is an authentic celebrity who can speak to me? And the reality is that he's kind of a natural. I was listening to the way he was sort of dancing around the questions. He has this soaring rhetoric. He deals in generalities. He's at least so far rather deft at sidestepping any specifics. But you're right. There is something Trumpian about him because he is sort of interesting to watch, but apparently does not have the campaign infrastructure that a more traditional politician would have. But that's not necessarily a negative. So what lane is he in? I was sitting there trying to think this through. That it strikes me as that he'd be acceptable to most of the wings of the party, but he really poses a challenge to the, and I say this as an old white guy myself, to the old white guys at the front of the pack. If the Democrats are in the mood for something really different, and they just can't stomach the idea of a 70-year-old white guy, Bernie or Biden, Beto certainly he certainly provides an alternative. Now, of course, then the question is he not diverse enough? Because in the intersectional world of Democratic politics, skin color and gender is very important.
Yeah. So I'll draw everyone's attention to JVL's piece on the Bulwark today about mm-hmm. Biden and Beto being the biggest threat to Republicans. And I will say I did write that on December 11th. It was that Biden-Beto was the best shot for the Democrats to win the mm-hmm. White House. And that is because it is a mix of the experience that terrified Americans are craving and a sure shot at beating Trump, which Joe Biden provides in a general election, the ability to win back Never Trump Republicans to win back the Midwest and to calm freaked out people is something that no one else brings in this large field. Beto brings Texas. He came within 2.6 percentage points of Ted Cruz. Not only is he really interesting and really authentic, which I think people crave, I think they're looking for a solid character that they can trust and latch onto. And for many people, that's more important than a policy menu. But Beto can turn 38 electoral votes and change the entire game of the presidential campaign map. And that is really exciting to donors, you have to understand. And so I think he's a Rorschach test. I think what he does well is bob and weave, like you said, won't, you know, sign on to the Green New Deal like Kamala Harris mistakenly did before it became a punchline at a Trump rally. And I think that he, you know, he said a few days ago he's a capitalist. He says he doesn't like labels. His ability not to be tied down combined with a real gutsiness, you know, he did challenge Sylvester Reyes, an incumbent who was endorsed by President Obama. That's how he won his first seat. He's a gutsy guy, and I've actually seen him in small settings. He's incredibly cerebral and smart like Obama, but he doesn't talk that way on the trail, which I think is really interesting and effective. So I think that this mania, this Beto show, could boom or bust. He comes off a little goofy. He has these manic hand signals. He, you know,
seems I do not want to see him at the dentist's office.
Right. No one wants to. And I don't know what he'd be like on a debate stage, you know, against all the other prosecutors and, you know, longtime veterans of the system and all that. And other people who are also authentic. But I do know how he's going to charm his way in these one-on-one settings, if it's a room of 200 people in a coffee shop or whatever, because he has that very interesting, unique mix of things I just said. And 38 electoral votes in the Lone Star State, I think, is the top of the list.
Yeah, but there's no way there's going to be a Biden-Beto ticket, because the Democrats are not going to have two white guys at the top of the
ticket. Well, that's exactly the response I got to my column on December 11th. Like, great idea, AB. No way two white dudes. There are schools of thought in the party, and it is not that the school of thought that you have to have an African American woman to turn out the most promising sector of the coalition, African American women, and excite them to win. That school of thought has not actually won out. It is a prominent school of thought, but the Democratic Party knows that if they lose to President Trump, they should go into a basement and hide in perpetuity. And so that's really scary to them. And we're also looking, Charlie, at a very long primary. What party insiders have told me they think is going to be 14 months long till next May. We are a long way from it has to be this type of person or it has to be that type of person. We just don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm old enough to know when all the buzz was about Jeb Bush and Scott Walker.
Yep.
As the rising stars in the Republican Party. There's going to be a backlash at some point among Democrats to all of the adulation for Beto. I was on MSNBC earlier, and when I was driving home, I heard someone, actually, I heard somebody, I think it was probably on CNN now that I'm trying to remember, was lamenting, why is there all this excitement about Beto? Why is, you know, Kamala Harris not getting this kind of excitement? Why is Stacey Abrams? Is this sexist? Is this just a guy? And of course, the cover story in Vanity Fair was the kind of fawning puff piece that no conservative will ever get. Yeah. Not just in our lifetime, but in the lifetime of our children and our children's children. And so there's got to be a certain amount of eye rolling. But look, we live in an age of celebrity candidates. So I'm not betting against him now.
I mean, I think, you know, there are so many things about that profile to be criticized, that he comes off, as I said, sort of quasi-Trumpian, that it's all about him. But look, the people who love Trump. He can change his policy position three times in a day and they don't care. And that is not good for democracy, but I think that's part of Beto's appeal. And you're right, the other contestants will be extremely irritated by it and likely try to do harm to him behind his back. But the point is that we do see that personality is a very potent power.
And he's likable. And yeah. he's a likable yeah. guy. And by the yeah. way, I hate myself for this because I was sitting there thinking I got to be the guy who doesn't get into the whole Betomania thing, who puts the brakes on it, who points out that maybe he's not ready for prime time, that losing a Senate race in Texas does not necessarily mean that you are presidential, you know, nominee material. That's what I wanted to be the guy to say that. Instead, question is asked to me, so, you know, how plausible is he? What does he bring to the table? And I'm the guy that brings up Abraham Lincoln losing the 1858 Senate election.
And that's actually that's what the donors who were at Beto's doorstep begging him to run were telling him. You're Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, see, that's
and
the thing.
That's the path.
Now, I'm trying to be restrained. I'm trying to be the voice of reason. And I'm the freaking guy that compares Beto O'Rourke to Abraham Lincoln. So well, just kill me now.
You didn't have to go that far, Charlie. What you could have said is we have Donald Trump as president and the bar has gone down very low and you don't have to have governing or military experience to win over enough of the electoral college map.
Well, that's true. And I, you know, just sort of parenthetically, if you support Donald Trump and think Donald Trump was qualified to be president, make the case that Oprah Winfrey is not qualified to be president.
Exactly.
I challenge you. You can't do it. You have a very interesting column today about Nancy Pelosi and a lot of eyebrows being raised. Nancy Pelosi coming out against impeachment, which, of course, has generated a great deal of heartburn in the progressive wing of the party. Why do you think she did it? And was this a smart move to preemptively said, yeah, we're not doing that even before the Mueller report comes out?
I thought it was so shrewd. And I'm making the case in my column today that she denied it not only to the Democrats, but to Trump, because allies around Trump will openly admit that they were going to galvanize their base with impeachment that would ultimately fail and he would not be convicted in a Senate trial, of course. And it could very likely would boomerang on the Democrats the way that it did on Republicans in the 90s. And so Pelosi was around for that. Then later in the early 2000s, she was Speaker when liberals begged her to try to impeach George W. Bush over the Iraq War. She has been to this rodeo and she is not a fool. She knows exactly which members made her Speaker again. They are in swing districts. They beat Republicans either in Hillary districts, some Republicans in Trump districts like Virginia 7, New York 22, Oklahoma 5. She needs to protect them and what she did to give them cover. The Mueller report is another day, right? We'll reassess it then. They'll shame their Republican colleagues into a bipartisan impeachment if the level of crimes rises to that. She's dealing with the now. And what she's saying is we're going to try to beat him fair and square at the ballot box in November of 2020. We are not out to get him on a party line vote. And that it gives cover to her members, Charlie, who are drowning in news about Paul Manafort and Michael Cohen and a national emergency and Ilhan Omar's anti-Semitic tropes and tweets. And they can't get any messaging home in their swing and moderate and centrist districts about anything that the House is doing. And they're really at risk of not being reelected. And that's the bottom line here. And I also point out they don't have to put the senators through a trial to list all. They can run ads if Mueller finds obstruction of justice or the Southern District does, naming all of the senators who are in office right now who voted against President Clinton to impeach him for obstruction of justice, starting with Lindsey Graham, who wanted to cleanse the office and said, you don't lose your job in this constitution just over a crime. It's just honor and integrity. So there is a path here to use sort of the impeachment specter without actually impeaching.
You know, also House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer also had something interesting to say. And I got a sense that there was some frustration bubbling up when he was asked about this push to impeach. He said, we've got 62 new members. 62 new Democratic members, not three. And I thought, wow, that was interesting. I mean, he's obviously referring to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Rashida Tlaib, and Ilhan Omar, who've been, you know, getting all of this attention. And I have been asking the question, why are we not talking about, you know, the moderate Democrats that you just described who actually won the election for the Democrats, the Connor Lambs, et cetera? Why are we talking about these three? And my sense is that you're getting a lot of frustration, and I think you just said this, a lot of frustration from Pelosi and Hoyer and the other grown-ups in that caucus that, hey, we actually have a whole freshman class here that are not defined by these three.
It's very frustrating to them, and I'm a big fan of Steny Hoyer's, have been for a long time. He's actually, you know, we can say this now that Speaker Boehner left. You know, they are very good friends. They are institutionalists. They care about the system our founders gave us, unlike these new cats. And he actually, I think his exact quote was something like, if you asked Americans, they think there's only three new members of the Democratic caucus. And you're right. Those three are giving them heartburn. And it was it was 33 of the 40 primary challenges moderate Democrats won.
Yeah.
And the bluer districts that went bluer, like Ayanna Pressley's and Ocasio-Cortez's, did not make a majority. So this is really something that they're struggling with, not only because they like Trump, and I call them the Trumpian trio in a recent column, because they just, facts don't always matter. Offending people is the game. No publicity is bad. I mean, bad publicity is still good publicity. It's all about your, you know, gangster Instagram game. And basically, they are sucking up all the oxygen, but then behind closed doors, they're also making threats about keeping a list of moderates who work with Republicans. So this is a very problematic strain, not only for the Democrats, but for our general governance, like the Freedom Caucus before them. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a bunch of real cliffs that we will be on this year as a government. Very scary. We've breached the debt ceiling. The Treasury Department is using extraordinary measures to get us through the next couple of weeks and months before we're on a cliff again with that. We have to break the Budget Control Act of 2011 spending caps once again, because the sequester was designed to save us money, but both parties always raise the cap, so we never do. And then we have to get to 2020 appropriations all by September 30th, which is 6 months and a few days from now. So these are all threats, I mean, all cliffs that President Trump can, you know, blow us up on. And it is really going to be very difficult road ahead, not only on these questions of impeachment investigations, but to get these people to come to the table and off of their bandwagons and govern.
Well, speaking of, I got to ask you about this, since we're talking about the Democrats and their problems. You saw the Paul Ryan tweet. You saw that,
yes.
Right? Okay. Now, you know, the Paul Ryan, I'm going to put my hand up. Paul Ryan and I are friends. And as I've told him, though, we're taking a break. We're seeing other people.
Right.
Okay. But so he's in a he gives a lecture down in Vero Beach, Florida. And he says the person who defines the presidential race next year is going to win that race. If this is about Donald Trump and his personality, he is not going to win it. And no, a couple of beats yesterday, he backtracks and tweets out, to be clear, GOP wins elections when they're about ideas, not when they're personality contests like Dems and media want. We are clearly better off because real Donald Trump, his record of accomplishment is why he will win re-election, especially when compared to the Dems' leftward lurch. So, AB, why?
I just was so surprised to see that because I want to know who the person is that convinced him he had to write that tweet, because you saw Kevin McCarthy. He was asked about it on middle of the day on Monday by reporters, and it was just another chance for him to say, of course the president, my best buddy, is going to win re-election because everything he does is great. He's delivered on all his promises from his campaign. And I don't know, in retirement from Congress and at least now from politics, why Paul Ryan would feel that he had to, I guess there's someone obviously on the Trump campaign hoping that he can still win Wisconsin. Maybe that person got to him, but I thought it was unnecessary, and I was stunned.
I thought it was unnecessary because at this point, you know, you're free. You are liberated.
Right.
You know, head toward the light, Paul. It's right up there. But his comments about Republicans need to win, run on ideas, not personalities. This is something he said many, many times in the past. So in some ways, it was very boilerplate for Paul Ryan.
Also, Charlie, he's right. I mean, he is absolutely right. The Republicans know that if the president only talks about walls and emergencies and doesn't actually offer a more aspirational, economically focused, healthcare focused message that is promising those voters that, you know, went from Obama to Trump in 16 something beyond that damn wall, he's not going to win. And so, I mean, I'm not saying the Democrats have figured it out, but I'm saying that, you know, the donors around Trump, the people who want him to win, know that, you know, you can't dine out on Gorsuch and Kavanaugh and the tax bill that no one can campaign on very long. And you have to move on to something that you're going to do for them next. And right now he's just basically saying, I'm not governing until I get a wall. So yeah. Paul Ryan is correct.
No, he is correct. I was also surprised that he backed off. Although at this point, it's kind of naive to be surprised by that. Right. I want to get to the emergency, but I had to ask you about this. So this morning, the day that we are talking, the House of Representatives voted unanimously, which almost never happens, for a resolution urging the Department of Justice to release the Mueller report. Now, my question: this is a good thing, I guess, except that anytime you see unanimous, it's either because it's not controversial or because it's so meaningless as to be, well, bullshit. So which is this one? I mean, when Matt Gaetz votes for it, what are we supposed to make of this?
It's a non-binding resolution, so he gets to tell his constituents that he's for good governance, but he gets to tell the president, don't worry, this, you know, tactically means nothing, and it doesn't mean that the Congress can force the disclosure of the report.
So bullshit.
Yeah. I mean, the Democrats would love it to be binding, but they're not empowered to do that. So it's a show vote and therefore, unfortunately, it is meaningless, even though it should be, you know, a law or something required.
Well, you and I are talking right now in sort of this odd no man's land. We're waiting for the Senate vote on the emergency declaration. It's a foregone conclusion that Republicans are going to enough Republicans are going to break with Trump that the Senate's going to pass the resolution of disapproval, which will trigger his. Well, I was going to say first veto. It may be his second veto because he also has been now rebuked for the support of the Saudi Arabian war in Yemen. So you have two bad votes coming out of Congress in 1 week. But as of our conversation right now, and things can change, we have Lamar Alexander saying that he's going to vote for this resolution of disapproval. You have Mitt Romney saying he's going to vote for this. It does feel a little bit like a jailbreak. What is your – and it's a free vote since – obviously, it will be vetoed and they won't override it. So what is the mood and why are so many Republicans feeling free to buck the president on his signature issue?
Well, Charlie, this has, you know, like a lot of other tense moments, been kept largely under wraps, except for, I guess, some crosswords with Vice President Pence recently at a lunch. But the reason that Ben Sasse and Ted Cruz and Lindsey Graham got into a car last night to show up uninvited to the White House to try to change the president's mind is because they're desperate. This is an incredibly awful jam, maybe the worst one the president has put them in yet. He put them through. The administration asked last spring for $1.6 billion for his wall. The Congress gave it to them. Then he flipped out and decided he wanted more. The Congress didn't give it to him. He shut the government down, put the Republicans in a jam. He declared an emergency, put them in a jam. This is a constitutional question. They are members of Congress. Mm-hmm. They know exactly what kind of precedent this sets. Now, the Matt Gaetzes, I did hear Matt Gaetz say that he would be against a Democrat using this in the future because they could declare parts of this country shut down with coal mines on it or whatever because of a climate change emergency. Then in the House, he votes with the president, of course. Because the law from 1976 is so broadly written and the statute is so bad, conservatives have told me I can hide behind this law and say he's within his legal rights to do it. It's Congress's fault. It's a bad statute. OK, so you can support the president by saying the NEA is just right. So bad. But Lamar Alexander and Mitt Romney and all the people that have been so upset over this and are poised to vote with Democrats know that it's still they must choose the Constitution and their mandate under Article 1 to control the power of the purse and the power sharing agreement set up by the founders. And Trump has done everything to make it about him and the wall and not the Constitution. As we know, he doesn't pay a lot of attention to the Constitution and the power sharing set up in our government. But I'm not surprised that that Mitch McConnell, as you know, Charlie, weeks before, like in the end of January, went to the White House and said privately, "You must not do this. You must not put us in this corner." And he did it anyway. So
Mitch rolled over.
But he didn't really roll over, right? I mean, I think, you know, I don't think he's whipping this to spare the president embarrassment. I think Mitch McConnell will be happy if Pat Roberts, who's retiring, would come out and vote against it. And, you know, he could get some people like Isaacson and people who might not be running again to just come out and say no, you know, even though it won't be overridden. This is wrong.
So what did happen at that meeting last night?
The president apparently became irritated. A lawyer was brought in to explain why it's not going to work. I guess he's been convinced that the statute permits this, the 1976 law, and he said no. And he said no to Mike Lee. In his effort, everyone is bending over backwards, as you've watched carefully, Charlie, to try to make this work for President Trump when it actually imperils their Senate majority next year with people up in, you know, all these states where Democrats have, you know, incredible momentum. It's amazing to me how much they've tried to hold his hand.
Okay, so Mike Lee has played a very interesting role in all of this because, you know, he is a self-described constitutionalist. He's got that Article One project, and he tried to come up with a compromise that would have essentially said, okay, we're going to let you have this, but then let's amend the law going forward to make it, to water it down to have whatever emergency declaration you issue expire. And that seemed to have had some traction for a while. Now, Nancy Pelosi said she wasn't going to go for that, so it killed it. Did you see Ala Pundit's piece in Hot Air yesterday? Oh, by the way, I have no idea who Ala Pundit is.
I saw the president's tweet this morning basically saying that he might be amenable to that later. So he sort of reversed overnight a little bit.
Well, but he shot it down. So yeah. This is what Ala Pundit wrote. He said Trump could have called Pelosi's bluff and placed the onus on House Democrats to show how serious they are about reining in presidential power. If Pelosi kept her word about blocking Lee's bill in the House, Trump would have secured a total victory. He'd have managed to kill off Pelosi's resolution and avoided having to keep his promise to sign Lee's bill into law. And then he could have blamed Pelosi for the whole thing. He could say, "I care about limiting presidential emergency powers more than she does. I was ready to sign Mike Lee's bill. Nancy wouldn't pass it." And yet President Deal didn't take that. And and then left Mike Lee kind of hanging out there, and Lee's going to go, "Okay, then if that's where you're going to be, I tried to make a deal with you. I'm voting against you on this one."
That is a very, very genius thesis. I'll give credit to Ala Pundit. And what we've learned from watching the president is that he doesn't make deals. He makes fights. And that's what he prefers. He took four positions on the Congressman Goodlatte bill on immigration last year in the course of several days. His proposal got the fewest Senate votes on immigration. He doesn't want resolution. He tried to blow up the healthcare negotiations a million times. Ultimately, they failed. He basically was left out of the tax reform negotiations by the congressmen and senators who knew that if they would never get another check for their campaigns again if they didn't deliver that bill, and they largely delivered it without him. He doesn't govern, he doesn't lead, he doesn't bring people together, and he doesn't negotiate. He has fits, or he goes back to TV shows where he says, "I want a DACA bill of love, let's take all the guns, I'm a Democrat," or whatever he says that day. And then he blows things up. But if you watch carefully and you speak to the people who've tried to work with him on trade and other issues, tax reform, repeal and replace of healthcare, everything, if you talk to Republicans, they just drive him bananas. I mean, he drives them bananas. He changes his position, and he really stays on offense. He doesn't like resolution.
No, I love that line that he doesn't make deals, he makes fights. That is pretty good. And that really does this whole illusion about him being a deal maker. So, boy, by the end of the day, I think it's going to be very interesting, I think, because to see who votes which way. But this is really a decisive, defining vote for a lot of Republicans. And you really do get the sense that even though the conservative media has generally fallen in line with Trump, on this issue, it's pretty uniform Whether it's the Bulwark, which you probably expect, but National Review, almost across the board, you're seeing columnists and pundits and thinkers who are saying this emergency declaration is a bad idea constitutionally and sets a horrible precedent. So this is one of the I assume, by the way, the sycophants and on Fox News and on talk radio will continue supporting all of this, but the president finds himself more isolated, I think, on this issue.
Well, I mean, Charlie, you are right. It is a defining issue, and it is a true test of their respect for our system, which will outlast President Trump. And it is, and you're right that I've noticed that as well. All of the urging from all of the different conservative publications. I read with interest Mark Thiessen's column. It was almost a month ago, saying that the president should not ask Republicans to choose between the Constitution and him. And if they are forced to choose, they must choose the Constitution. I was very upset to see that Tom Tillis, in a race in North Carolina next year, where Democrats will be very energized and will be getting out their vote, came out to for the resolution of disapproval, more than a week ago, and then was hedging the last few days because conservatives around him at home in the, not policy or constitutional conservatives, right? But I don't know, people wanting to threaten him with a primary challenge gave him cold feet. So this is a very, very important test, and it speaks to the coming test on any other constitutional crises that might arise with the results of the investigations.
Well, the Tillis case is interesting because if in fact he is hedging and fudging, it is because of this concern about whether or not you'll be primaried. And I wonder whether or not the size of the vote today is at least in the back of people's minds, providing a little bit of cover for folks like that. Is there any number in your mind that you would say, wow, that's really impressive? That's more than I thought it would be. I'm going to go out on a limb and say if there are 12 Republicans that voted against Trump on this, that would be a kind of a wow moment.
Yes, I agree. I mean, I think 10 is still brave in this age where they don't buck him ever. But I think 12 would be significant. And I do think what's unfortunate is what they're hearing from like town party officials and stuff who just are reading the president's tweets, that it's about a border wall. And it's about, defying President Trump, and you're pro-crime and you're pro-MS-13 if you don't vote for with the president on this. So it really is, I'm sure what they're hearing at home is incredibly black and white and not about their constitutional prerogative and the separation of powers. But they really, I really would love it if there were 20 of them. I mean, I just don't, it's just not right.
No, I agree with you on this. I want to go back to something you said earlier that we talked about, because, if in fact Trump thinks he's going to run for re-election by just talking about the wall caravans, obviously that's not going to expand his constituency. But one of the things that did strike me, having to sit there and listen to a half hour of Beto O'Rourke earlier this morning, was that he has a way of connecting with real world problems in a very sort of granular way, by which I mean there's always that question in the polls that ask, does so-and-so share your values? Does he understand? Is he in favor of people like you? You know what I'm saying? They're the people like you. And this is something that candidates like Beto O'Rourke do extremely well. And I think it's a real point of vulnerability for the Republicans, because if they want to run on the, just hammering away at the wall and the, how terrible and the carnage in America and everything, as opposed to a guy that's going to talk about who's getting his kids breakfast and on the school bus and how teachers handled their classrooms and what it means for farmers who have to figure out how to market soybeans. Beto O'Rourke, in that sense, is relatable in a way that Trump will never be.
Exactly. And that's really significant, because Trump's understanding people like you numbers are terrible right now. And those matter, as we've seen in every presidential election. That's almost always an indicator of the winner. And And what's interesting is Biden is coming in, Charlie, with a more optimistic message, like enough of the carnage and we're suckers and everything is a disaster. We can do this. We're not as divided as everyone wants us to think, and we don't have to hate each other. We have to get together. And it'll be interesting, though, he is a longtime government official, you know, senator and vice president and Judiciary Committee chairman, who is going to tell a lot of tales and probably, you know, talk in a stodgy way, whereas Beto O'Rourke's ability to articulate really, as you said, sort of granular policy solutions in a very easy, compelling conversational way that very much relates from the bus driver to the hairdresser to the, you know, guy who runs the barbecue shop to the banker to the doctor to the teacher immediately. It is very effective.
Yeah,
and it'll make more people listen. You combine that with his just general cult following of people who like his videos and send $25 because he's really awesome. It's really why I think he just can't be ignored, even though he's a white dude.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. So do you want to do something really foolish and weigh in on the Tucker Carlson controversy? You can say no if you want. Right?
Tucker is my friend of a quarter century, and I think you can imagine, as a working mother of three, I'm not fond of comments that put down women. But I also I know what a good person he is, and I think this whole thing is very painful. That's all I'll say. I'm not going to.
Okay, that's.
I don't really want to weigh in on free speech and outrage mobs, because it depends on the week, right? Who's mad at the outrage mob? So that whole thing about our kind of tribal corners, and who chooses to be mad at who claims that their free speech is being squelched this week, tends to flip back and forth.
It is kind of like a kabuki dance.
It's very frustrating. I mean, people have been asking, rightfully so, you know, where were the free speech, you know, advocates when Ilhan Omar was, when we were asking her to be named in a resolution for her anti-Semitic remarks. This is a very difficult time. We're having difficult debates, but I'm also surprised with the obsession.
Well, I mean, it is the game that we play here. I actually was foolish enough to weigh in on all of this today, and people can find my piece not at the Bulwark, but on my own website, where I talked about this with David French the other day, and I've kind of changed my perspective on it, because I said I was in favor of a statute of limitations for dumb things you've said in the past, but I'm not sure that even a really generous amnesty helps out, Tucker, who, you know, did all of this back in 2006, you know, when he's a grown up and he's an established professional. But having said that, I don't think that he ought to be fired, because I don't think this whole lynch mob thing where, you know, if I found something you said 10 years ago, you should be fired today. If you're going to be fired, it's for something you're saying right now. So, I mean, I do think that, look, Media Matters does not want to debate with Tucker Carlson. They want to destroy him. I think you can, you know, recognize that. But two, you can also acknowledge, or I can acknowledge, that, you know, what Tucker Carlson said was appalling. I mean, it was racist. It was crude. I mean, the stuff about Miss Teen USA. So I don't think he ought to be fired. I think he ought to be held accountable. I wish he would apologize. And I also think the conservatives should not choose this hill to die on, because at some point it's like, really, guys, it's just there are some things that shouldn't be defended because they're indefensible. And I'm guessing that at some – I don't know Tucker Carlson. You're friends with him. At some level, if you got him in a room – he'd be embarrassed by this. You know, I mean, if he did apologize, it might actually be sincere, because he's thinking, oh, man, I embarrassed myself in front of my family and in front of my – how do you explain this to my daughters? Not to mention, this certainly does not advance any cause that he cares about. I mean, there is nothing, you know, in his agenda that is advanced by his musings with Bubba the Love Sponge.
Right.
So
it's very interesting. People have different personalities. So you know, Tucker is a bombastic, you know, extroverted dude, and he doesn't back down ever from anything. And then you have, you know, someone like Joe Biden, and people he's going to announce any time now. And both liberals in the primary and Republicans are going to say what you said on tape in the hearing room to Anita Hill and other musings in your whole career are absolutely on trial right now. Biden will be very contrite, and he'll be very, he'll say he's changed and all this stuff. But we're in an age of like digging up the videotape, and everyone has to, you know, come to Jesus, and everyone responds differently. Trump, obviously defiant. Bernie Sanders has this problem as well. It's the problem is the standards keep changing for who, well, you know, should be punished in what way.
Well, that's it. We make them up. But, you know, with this whole part of the Trumpian culture is this adamant belief that you should never apologize, that you must always fight back. And you know, this is almost like it's baked in. But don't you think that, I mean, do you think that apologies are a sign of weakness? I always think they're a sign of character. I think one of the hardest, bravest things to do in the world is to look back and say, boy, you know what? I made a huge mistake. I was a butthead. I should not have done that. I deeply regret it. I think people accept that. But the notion now is never surrender, never give an inch, never apologize. And I'm not sure this is an enhancement for our culture.
Well, I agree. And during the Kavanaugh, the Trump sort of seal of the anti-apology seal of approval is corrosive. And I actually saw that most clearly in the Kavanaugh confirmation hearing when I thought that he should have said, I don't know of these allegations. They sound terrible and hurtful. I've never been accused by my friends of this, but when I was 17 years old, I drank irresponsibly, as did my friends, and I'm sorry that I did. And it's hard for me to say this today, but he wasn't contrite. He was, he was defiant, and I think he did that because he was informed that Trump watched the TV show in the morning and thought that Christine Blasey Ford was winning the TV show, and he was going to lose it, and so forever. He will be remembered for coming out screaming at Senator Klobuchar about whether or not she's ever blacked out and how much she loves beer. And it's I think that never would have happened before President Trump.
I think that's exactly right. AB, thank you so much for joining
me
today. I really appreciate it. And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll be a lot smarter, right? And we'll do this all over again.